Yeah. And so, you know, this process of what we're doing here, in some ways it's taking on the practice that Plato suggested when someone came to him and asked him, you know, what's the important thing to do with one's life? Plato said, practice dying. Practice dying. And there's a lot in that. At a simple level, just facing what we're going to face when we get to that point. Before we get to that point, gives us some help for when we get to that point. It actually gives us some help for now as well, rather wonderfully. But it also gives some help for that place. And seeing, as you were saying, you know, what it can be, we are not guaranteed an easy exit. And attending to the patterns and habits of our mind that may make it even more difficult than it otherwise is going to be is something we want to do now. And in terms of the Buddha's teaching, this was again and again what he had to say. It's like, you know, work on your patterns while you have the chance, because there will come a time when they will pick you up and take you. And the more work you've done with freeing the mind from greed and hatred, the easier that journey is going to be. That simple. So that's why, you know, when the Buddha talks about the preciousness of life, it's not just its intrinsic preciousness, but it's like precious because it gives us this opportunity to wake up, to free the mind and heart. But it's really easy to think that there are some other things we should be doing instead of that, isn't it? Partly because of how we project into the future. What's important is put on hold. What's important gets, oh yeah, I'll get round to that when I've got a bit more time, slightly less files in my desk, you know, all of that. And yet, as I'm rather frequently found to be quoting the old saying, you know, nobody lay on their deathbed wishing they'd spent more time in the office. Unless, of course, what you do in your office is what you really love and think is most important. And if that's so, then why not? But it's not often what we experience in the office. And certainly that was the case for me when I was in my early 20s and went through university and qualified, had a job in a pretty high-powered office in Auckland, New Zealand, which was a small city but the largest of New Zealand, so it was pretty much as intense as it gets down under in that country anyway. And I was working in a law firm as a barrister and solicitor, and I'd come into the work with a real vision of doing something that could make a difference in the world, but the truth was I hated it, the work, and that the fact that it was an ongoing battle zone, even on the occasions when one got to be in battle on support of what was good, or I thought to be good, it was still a battle. It was still, you know, energetically about conflict, about overcoming, about conquering, and it was pretty unpleasant. And I knew it was unpleasant, and a lot of the time I didn't get to do things I wanted to. As a junior barrister or solicitor, you have to do what the boss tells you. And so I really wanted to leave, but I had nothing else that was holding the material side of my life together. Didn't have any sort of my family, and what the family had accumulated had sort of dissipated in various directions in the earlier years of my life. And something happened for me that is, as I said earlier, probably a large part of how I come to be sitting here now. And what it was, a very dear friend of mine who I'd grown up with and who'd been a really close friend and support for me when my family had sort of come apart at the seams. I'd spent a lot of time with him and his family in my early teens, and his place was the home that I went back to when I wasn't working or when I'd been at university. And he had an operation, a minor surgical thing, procedure that went wrong, and as a result of it, his intestine started to die. In sections, they took it out over 6 months till he had nothing left of the digestive system beyond a pipe going into his chest, giving him nutrients, because there were no veins left on his body that could support a needle. They'd all been filled with needles for 6 months, and so there was a pipe going straight in there, and there was an infection around it, and they couldn't
deal with that. It was one of those infections. And he had another pipe coming out just here, because that was about the distance, which was taking out the effluent. And he weighed probably about a half of what he had weighed by then. And after 6 months, he decided that actually there was no quality left in his life. He was addicted to the painkillers. He was on all kinds of medication to try and control the infections. And he said, actually, no, I don't want this. Just turn it all off. Take out all the pipes. Leave me. I think he was about 23, 24, as was I. And his death, in 2 weeks it took him to die, was quite a shock for me. Quite an impact in my life. And many of you have already spoken to me of people you've lost. Many of you haven't yet, or maybe won't, speak of people you've lost. Maybe you haven't. But most of us, somewhere along the line, do lose people we love. And it's totally appropriate that we may feel grief and anger, and that we might feel shock and disbelief and frustration, despair. And my friend Radar, we called him Radar, he had ears like this, like radar dishes. My friend Radar's death, it gave me a gift that I'm forever grateful for. And that it told me, it taught me in a way that I couldn't otherwise, I think, have got. I had to do it now, my life. I had to do it now. I had the thought, well, I can put up with the situation that I don't like and I'm not happy with for a few more years and just earn a bit of money and get a bit of security and try and have something like that. But I was really not at ease. I wasn't happy, and I wanted to look for something else that would give meaning and purpose and value that I wasn't finding in the activity that it seems the culture and society was presenting me as my life. Despite the fact on the outside it looked pretty good, I was doing pretty well. My Jewish grandmother in Israel could not believe until her death that I had given up my job, and kept asking me when I would go back to it, when I'd go to Israel to teach retreats. When are you going to become a lawyer again, she would ask me. Poor dear. She died in her 90s just a few years ago. But I was so fortunate in one sense that my friend died, because it shocked me into saying, don't wait with your life and what you love. Take the risk, and it was a risk for me. And I went travelling into Asia with no sense that I would necessarily ever come back to New Zealand or anything that I'd known. And along that journey I came into contact with the Dharma teachings, with these practices that are taught at London Insight and at Gaia House and elsewhere. And it's really transformed my life, all of that. And no doubt, well, of course, I have no idea what would have happened if my friend hadn't died. But his death really helped wake me up. And that's part of the power of contemplating death, of actually allowing ourselves to be opened by it. And as I said, the very clear message of recognizing, of turning towards, of prioritizing for oneself what is important. Because we don't get another chance. There's a little lapel button you can get to pin on your suit that says, this is not a rehearsal. This is it. It's not a rehearsal. This is your life. So what that says is, yeah, choose what it is that you love and make it the centre of your life. Remember those people that you love and tell them that you do. For many years after we were first together, my wife and I, we would say when we parted, as a practice, but also because it was real, we would say, even though it might just be going down the road, or as I was often, when I was starting to travel and teaching and, you know, going various countries, making a point at the parting moment of saying, I hope I see you again. Because it was true. To really just let it be known that, yeah, I do hope I see you again. Not just I love you, but I want to see you again. Knowing that there's no guarantee. And every time I get into a plane and I think, gosh, for that connection, I hope I come back. It's not guaranteed. And for others too. But that sense of really just bringing to mind what's important, really letting ourselves feel it. My other grandmother is now 95, lives in Sweden, and I go there to teach pretty much every year, and I spend about a week in Stockholm where she lives, and every time I'm there I think, will I see her again when I leave? Because she's 95, and she came and sat my retreat, 10-day retreat, when she was 92. First retreat ever, would you believe it? And great, like, she says she'll come and do another one, but I'm not sure. No, she's quite a person, but it's like, yeah, it's going to happen. And I say to myself, I should go and spend a week with her and have nothing else to do, another week, where I'm not seeing the other relatives. I should do that. And you know, there's a sadness in me because I haven't managed to do it. And if I don't manage to do it before she dies, that sadness will stay with me for a long time. I first met her when I was first in India, and I just discovered meditation, and I went to Calcutta, which is where she's from. She's Bengali. And I found this address in this little place, in this little thing, and there was this little old Indian woman who's my grandmother, my mother's mother. And you know, it turned out she was into meditation too. It was quite amazing. But you know, it's like she was a person in my family who related to the world I'd just discovered, and actually the only one still who really does. And yet I look at my life and how much I travel and all the things I do, and I think, why don't you just go and spend a week or two with her, rather than just managing a couple of half days on a visit every year, which is basically what I manage. And I can't answer that for myself. I don't know, apart from I'm busy and da-da-da, all the old excuses. But I do know, as I said, that I will be sad if it finishes like this. And I'm taking that risk every day. I choose to not do that with the next few days I have free in my life. And it's really interesting to live with that. It's really challenging, but it's true. That's how it is. So we have this precious opportunity, this being alive. And contemplating death, living in the truth and the reality and the reflection of it's not forever. This is something that is really worthy of our engagement with it. To live our life for now, for this that we have, because everything else is not guaranteed. And in terms of what I wanted to talk about and cover today, there's just one more piece, and it's really already been said, but by actually equally as much in the things you've shared as what I've reflected on. But Stephen Levine put it rather well in his book A Year to Live, which was based on a practice and a teaching which he's been offering for 20 years or more, I think now, in which people are invited to live a year as if it really was their last year, to do all the things they would do if they knew it was ending on a given date, and just live that way. And you can actually, there are courses, I don't know if he still teaches them, but people teach this as a practice and a training, and will run in London, I'm sure, and things like that. Very powerful. I've not done the year-long process, but in the book, I think somewhere towards the end, he observes, and I think it's very apt. He says, in this practice in A Year to Live, one of the things he learned and understood, he said, was that love is the only rational act of a lifetime. Love is the only rational act of a lifetime. And it's interesting to me because we tend to think love is the sort of not rational thing, and rational things are to do with, you know, all those other things. But in the end, what makes sense is just this. Love. In all the different ways it shows itself, which can include, of course, sometimes being firm and strong and saying no to something. That can involve reaching out and helping. That can involve forgiving, oneself and each other for the things that have gone wrong or that cause pain and harm. And letting ourselves know the love is very much the fruit of letting ourselves acknowledge the truth of death. They come together. Both the sense of preciousness and the sense of loss come out of this reality and this love. And this love arises because it's, and this preciousness comes because it's not forever. It wouldn't be the same if it was forever. Preciousness is intrinsically related to transience. Things we see beauty in are things that don't last. Flowers that wilt. Plastic flowers look exactly the same, but they're not beautiful. They might be pretty or attractive even, but they don't touch the heart because they're not dying. Sunsets captivate us, but if they just stayed in the sky, how long would it be? Nice reds, oranges and purples. What's for dinner? But they're changing and fading away. Something about the preciousness, when we ask, why must it be so? If it wasn't like this, the very reason we wanted to stay would be gone. And every time one of those noises goes past, you know, do you wonder? Is someone in danger? Is someone dying? And maybe one could think, may they be safe. I can't help them, but may they be safe. A simple response when we're open to that truth. So I'd like to complete or end this day in terms of what I'm teaching here at this point. There are a few people who, I'm just going to say a couple of things now before I hand over to the practical ending from London Insight Admin. Is that you, James? Or yes, okay. So there are a few people who won't be coming tomorrow who I'd like to meet. As soon as we're finished in here, I'd like to meet in the Tara room with you just for 5 or 10 minutes. And we're intending to finish and be gone by 5 o'clock. So we have a little time to just be together and clean out as well, I think. What I'd like to say for all of you, in fact, is to go gently from here as we transition. If you can not fill your evenings with email and television, I would encourage you not to fill them. There may be, of course, people you need to engage with. Of course, do what you need to do. Don't feel you need to bring everything that you've experienced, felt, or seen, or heard out and share it with everybody. It might be that you want to choose what, or even if, you share about this, and certainly be respectful to what feels appropriate for you in that. You're in a way leaving the safety of this space that we hold together to go out into a world that's full of a lot of other things. So be aware that you might be sensitive and open or affected. If you'd like to, and you certainly could, and it could be quite helpful or powerful to keep the contemplation a little bit alive, a sense of, oh, I'm not here forever. Oh, these people aren't here forever. I too will die. You too will die. If you'd like to bring that with you in some way, you're very welcome to. It's up to you. And tomorrow we'll begin again, 9:30 for 10, as far as I understand. So I'd like to wish you a safe transition back to where you're going and back to here tomorrow. And those of you who are not able to come tomorrow, which is just a small number, I'd really like to meet with you in the Tara room just as soon as we've done what we need to do here.